From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, after an incident of alleged profiling at the MFA, do our arts institutions have a race problem?
We're terribly sorry that these students had an experience that was not what we wish for anybody who visits the museum.
That and more in our Week in Review. Also today, former Vermont Governor Madeline Cunin.
That wasn't a likely candidate. I was a woman, I was Jewish, but somehow the people of Vermont trusted me.
And
Blackbird singing in the dead of night.
Rock and roll and Boston Ballet together at Boston Calling this weekend.
You have a bass drop, and then you have choreography that you would see in, like, the Nutcracker at the same time. How completely contrasting are those things, but how beautifully they actually go together.
It's all next on Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna, and it's Friday, so we'll dive right into our Week in Review. And we'll start with a developing story about a disturbing incident at the Museum of Fine Arts.
We're terribly sorry that these students had an experience that was not what we wish for anybody who visits the museum.
That's MFA Chief Brand Officer Katie Getchell speaking to Channel 7 about allegations brought forward by a group of Dorchester Middle School students and their teacher. They say they were racially profiled and harassed during a recent field trip, targeted by hateful racist remarks from other patrons and followed by a museum security guard. Here's teacher Marvelline Lammy on Channel 5.
As soon as we would walk, he would walk. When we stopped, he would stop. So at that point, I kind of grew uncomfortable. So I just told the kids, we're going to gather up and go.
Makiba McCreary, Chief of Learning and Community Engagement at the MFA, told WBUR that the museum will look into the incident, but she's most concerned about what happens next.
I would like to argue that it's even more so about what happens after that, which is ensuring that they know they belong here when they come into this museum, that they feel like it's their museum.
So what does happen next, and how do we make institutions like museums, predominantly white spaces, feel like it belongs to everyone? Let's turn to our Week in Review panelists. Joining us this week is Tito Jackson. He's CEO of Verdant Medical and a former Boston City Councilor. Councilor Jackson, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us this week is Tom Nichols, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Tom, good to see you as well.
Great to be back with you.
So we were just talking in the newscast about this, and I want to bring it to our listeners here live on the show and start with your reactions to this story, Tito.
It is obviously angering and frustrating. This is racism. And, you know, in the apology, let's start there. So institutions need to learn how to apologize. Conditional apologies. And I want to give props to my friend Tori Bullock, who did a video on this. So when you say it's not who we are, no, actually, it is who we are. It may not be who you aspire to be, but it is who you are. And so one of the things that we were saying a little bit earlier is that as a black person, oftentimes you need CSI level information or evidence to prove that something went on. And sadly, this is an actual institution in the city of Boston. And we know that institutions are made up of not only buildings, but people. And so there's a cultural component that needs to be dealt with here. And it is also very upsetting to me. These are 13-year-olds. These are young people. And oftentimes, young Black and Latino kids aren't really allowed to be young people. And it's really frustrating to me that in addition to it happening, that the response is kind of a covering of our tuchus instead of actually stepping forward to deal with these. And I do want to give props, and I want to make the distinction. Makiba McCreary has, I believe, made some very good statements. And I guess the last thing I'll say here is that look at your staff. Look at the makeup of your staff. So I went on the website. Mm-hmm. I want the MFA to look at their board. And I also want the MFA to actually look at the fact that Makiba McCreary is the only senior level person of color in the organization, other than and I know that there's a curator there. They need to really look at this as a teachable moment and determine what the next iteration of the MFA is.
So you said a lot there. But one of the things you said was about this sort of apology culture and that that's not who we are. And I think you might be referencing something that Marty Walsh said yesterday, at least to the Boston Globe. He said he finds what happened at the MFA disturbing and, quote, that's not who we should be and that's not who we are. But Boston City Councilor Kim Janney tweeted this last night. I'm so tired of the this is not who we are response to racism in Boston. That's exactly who we are. How can we move forward if response is always denial? Tom Nichols, is this who we are as a city, as a country?
I hope not. I think I understand. Of course, I'm not African-American. This hasn't happened to me. And so it's easier for me to say I understand when people say this is not who we are, because, of course, that's not who you want to be. But I also take the point that it's not who we are, but it's who somebody is. Who did the thing that was so disturbing. And I think it's almost healthier for an institution simply to say, look, somebody screwed up. We're going to find out what happened. You know, this is a bad thing, instead of the, well, it wasn't the experience we wanted. And we're, you know, and you go back and forth. You know, society's made up of human beings, and some of them are just bad people. You know, institutions are not going to have perfect people in them. And it's okay to admit that rather than to go through, you know, again, are we doing this en masse? And therefore, because I think what happens is institutions in general dig in and say, we have to say this is not who we are because we can't, you know, that's something we don't want to live with. And that's understandable. But like I said, it may not be who you are, but it's who somebody was.
I challenge institutions and I challenge people to sit with the uncomfortability of this, to sit with and actually deal with. And as a person of color, women, people from the LGBTQ community, you know what? It's uncomfortable. When people follow you around in a store and you possibly had a pocket full of money that you thought about spending there, and you feel like a second-class citizen when that happens. And so it's absolutely critical that people don't jump to this, hey, we're going to instantly fix it, that sit with it. Listen to what these young people are saying about what they experience and what they feel. And by the way, they're now 13, so this is not the first time that some of them have dealt with many of these issues. And we challenge you, institutions in the city of Boston, because by the way, when people talk about Boston writ large, we are sports teams, institutions, all of these other pieces. And there have been things that have happened in all of these venues. And so the confluence of that is something critical that we actually sit with. And as a person of color, we don't get to walk away hit the send button and be all done with this issue. I challenge the MFA to go out into every single Boston public school and have these interfaces. Boston public schools are about 80% students who are Black or Latino. And then we have about 7-8% Asian students. You know, get out there. Make these connections. By the way, hire some of them. Put them on your board. Mm-hmm. And actually help them determine the next generation of what this museum is going to look like. Because, by the way, they are the people in the city of Boston who will be going there. They are the ones, and we know the city of Boston and communities of color is younger and much browner. So they are your future. So if you don't do the right thing, your institution will not last into this next millennium.
Well, as we reported on WBUR, about 80% of the MFA's attendance, at least in 2015, is white. And so as part of that, we spoke to Stephen Locke. He was the artist in residence for the city of Boston in 2018 and a professor at MassArt. And he told us that this incident really shows why it has been so difficult to make places like museums, operas, and ballets more inclusive.
Culture is not white. Art is not white. What is happening is white supremacy is saying that these things belong to us and they don't belong to you. The barriers to going are the biases that people have about the audience. Black people like the ballet. Black people like opera. Black people like all that stuff. Why they aren't going is because the institutions don't welcome them.
So is there a way to make these institutions welcoming beyond what you just said, Councillor Jackson?
Well, first off, one, we need to use the word, and I know it's now a bad word, we need to use the word racism and stop dancing around what's going on and embrace it. Yes, there is an opportunity to actually rework these institutions. But one, it starts with coming to the table knowing that you don't know, knowing that you don't have the staff, necessarily the skill sets or training, and actually asking. actually building real relationships with neighborhoods and communities, but also putting people in positions of power and in leadership. And so that, to me, is a reflection of the institution. If you don't have people at the top tier of leadership at your institution, and you say that you believe in diversity, well, you know, when I was a city councilor, I would always say a budget is a value statement. So if you don't have people who are guiding your budgets as a whole, then that becomes an issue. And by the way, there's a bunch of fun things that happen at MFA. They recently had a really awesome party. I won't say it online, oriented towards the Black community. It was really awesome. There's the First Fridays event, but when it comes down to it, those don't happen in a vacuum. And in a bubble. When it comes down to what we have to do as a city and as a community, is we have to be willing to roll our sleeves up and have real, authentic conversations where people of color are at the table and not subordinated. The biggest issue in this situation is these young people actually felt, when they walked in there, uncomfortable about everything that was going on.
Speaking of institutions, good time to remind everybody I don't speak for any of the ones I work for. I admit, you know, there's a part of me that shuts down when someone says, you know, people don't go to the ballet because of white supremacy. On the other hand, I think it's a really important point. When 80% of your students are children, of color, are people of color, and 80% of your patrons are white, that there's a disconnect in the community. Yep. And I think that there's, you know, it's a great thing to work to overcome that disconnect. Some of the remedies that Tito's talking about, I think that makes perfect sense. I mean, whether it's, you know, institutional white supremacy, keeping people away from art or the ballet. Again, I'm not a member of a minority group. I don't know what that experience is like, but I'm not sure that that's a productive approach.
It sounds
to it
like sitting down at the table, having these conversations, hopefully can make a difference.
But you have to make a change, though. Understand, this is like addition and subtraction, right? So when it comes down to changing what's on the other side of the equal sign, if your outcome from what you currently are doing right now is 80% of the folks in a city that's a majority people of color,
right?
80% of the people who are coming in are white, then if you were selling candy bars or something else, you would actually really be thinking about that marketing and that marketplace. The question is, when it comes down to the real issue here, is do these institutions actually care to make the modifications? I'm hearing that the MFA wants to come to the table. I absolutely believe that they should come to the table, and I'm on the board, and I actually need to note I'm on the board of the Boston Ballet, and these are some of the issues and questions that we deal with on a regular basis, because just as noted with Mr. Locke, people, you know what? Black folks like ballet, and these cultural institutions should be open to everyone and not some people. And by the way, if you're going to survive in the future of the nation as well as the city of Boston, you better get this right. And these young people, by the way, are going to be around a long time after all of us are here. So if you believe in your institution and want to see it grow and thrive in the future, you better fix it.
I have long, long memories. And, you know, wow, we want to make sure we leave some time for other topics today, including politics. It's just a small topic. The president this week reportedly stormed out of a meeting with Democrats on Wednesday, upset over Speaker Nancy Pelosi's accusation that Trump is engaged in a cover-up. He then stepped out into the Rose Garden and said this.
Well, it turns out I'm the most, and I think most of you would agree to this, I'm the most transparent president probably in the history of this country.
And Speaker Pelosi responded, sounding more like she was talking about a troubled relative than the leader of the free world.
I pray for the president of the United States. I wish that his family or his administration or his staff would have an intervention for the good of the country.
Of course, she stopped short of calling for impeachment, and there's a split in the Democratic Party over this idea. Pelosi has held strong that the party should not go down that road just yet, but according to an NBC News count, some 31 House Democrats have now called for the impeachment process to begin. So let's start there. Is impeachment, Tom Nichols, a trap for the Democrats?
There's no good solution now. I think that impeachment may be politically unpopular, but at this point it could well be a constitutional duty. I mean, you can't avoid doing something that the Democrats can't step forward and say he's obstructed justice, he's abused power, but for the
Pelosi's even said that, you know, he's right. definitely committed impeachable
right.
offenses.
He's committed impeachable offenses, but for the sake of political expediency, we're actually not going to go down that road. I think Republicans are very much hoping to draw the foul here. And to have a Bill Clinton moment where he goes through impeachment, goes out on the South Lawn, cheers. Of course, people forget that the year after Bill Clinton was acquitted, a Republican won the White House. So there may be other lessons in there. But I think to some extent, the president
razor-thin Supreme Court margin.
But unexpectedly. Republicans always said at the time, if Al Gore could have won his home state, he'd have been president. And he didn't. There are risks for the Democrats, but I think it's getting – and I was actually more sympathetic to that early on to say, I get it. They don't want to go down – because the Senate's going to acquit them no matter
right.
what. I mean the Republican Party is completely a monolith at this point from top to bottom with the honorable exception of Justin Amash of – just kind of standing alone. But on the other hand, if this isn't impeachable – if the president's behavior isn't impeachable, then you might as well just scratch it out of the Constitution. Because if this isn't it, nothing is.
Now, Tito Jackson, as I said, Democrats are split over this issue. And this week we spoke with Massachusetts Representative Catherine Clark and asked her what she thought of the disagreement within the party over whether to pursue impeachment.
I think what it shows is that while our party may have some differences in timing and tactics, we are more committed than ever in making sure that we hold this president accountable.
Now, the president would argue this is all just a witch hunt, but are Democrats holding him accountable?
I think Democrats need to hold each other accountable for having a backbone and actually standing up and ensuring that we do what's right, which may not always be what's popular. And so this is the quandary of the Democratic Party, right, is what to do in these difficult situations. These are the rallying cries. And so, by the way, I don't believe there's a middle anymore. Right. So this component of like, hey, we're going to play to the middle and the independents in the middle. You're not getting them. And so what you need to do.
So you don't think the middle exists anymore?
If you're in a situation when you're saying Trump or no Trump, I don't think there's a middle there, right? I think maybe in 2016 there might have been some folks, and you had people who were Bernie or bust or some or they're the same. I don't think that that's necessarily the case now. I think there needs to be bold, courageous leadership that actually steps up and holds him to account. And that would also galvanize a Democratic base that didn't come out for Hillary. So this is the other component, is that you didn't see those Obama level turnouts. And that's why states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, that we weren't actually able to pull that together. So I personally believe in it. I heard a funny thing that we have a Baskin Robbins, almost a Baskin Robbins election.
Yeah.
That's going to happen, 32 different flavors. But when it comes down
to
this,
there it was 23 and me.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, 23. Yeah, I like that. Right.
I'm not running.
But I think there's definitely something that should come out of this that could also galvanize the Democrats.
Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was going to say, I think there are two things going on here. One is, as somebody who's part of the Never Trump camp, I always worry that Democrats are going to
stay in that camp.
And I've stayed in that camp.
Thank you.
I have never, from day one until now, as Ronald Reagan would say, I stayed the course. I always worry that Democrats are going to be too consumed by their internecine struggles. I mean, when Jay Inslee and, I can't even name some of the other guys that are running for president, Bill de Blasio, it's like this to me is the Democrats potentially taking their eye off the ball. The other thing I think is happening, though, is I think Pelosi wants to get to the point where she says, look, we backed ourselves against the wall and tried every possible way to avoid this, and he has left us no choice. So I think if Representative Clark is right, and this is where, because it sounds like she's hinting that's where
right.
they're moving,
mm-hmm.
I think Pelosi wants to be able to say, you know,
we tried to avoid.
We tried everything we could. Even that thing about an intervention was almost like her saying, "Well, someone please do something that isn't us." And I think, you know, that rubbed me a little bit the wrong way, because she's like, "If only someone would stage an intervention." Well, you know, you being the Article I power of the Constitution, you actually have that power to do that. But I think that's what they're trying to get to, so that they don't look like they rushed into it.
So this Week in Review has gotten away from us. We're short on time here, and I just want to make sure that we leave some space for our hubbubs, those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Tom, let's start with you.
Once again, I have a joint Massachusetts-Rhode Island hubbub, because I'm a son of the Commonwealth who was transplanted to Rhode Island, and it's about the president putting his finger on the scale of this casino bill, trying to advantage the casinos that are run by friends of his in Rhode Island. And the reason I thought of this, and the reason it made me laugh, is that I just spent a week on vacation in Las Vegas, and it's so weird to come back to New England and say, boy, it was really nice to be someplace where gaming is really clean and above board and well run.
Are you looking to buy the Wynn Casino?
No. No, I'm not giving Steve Wynn another dime.
And
Council Jackson.
I was actually going to steal the Wynn Casino as my hubbub, since it wasn't brought up. I think this is actually, it shows how important the issue of having a gaming commission who actually puts in the right language. There should never have been language that allowed them an out in their ability to have that say, to push the sale forward.
And you're talking about, of course, this back and forth this past week between MGM and Wynn, whether they were going to swap or something.
Exactly.
Sell the Everett Casino.
And, you know, we see that many of these corporate, essentially, giveaways become an issue. And we also see the same when it comes to General Electric. You had the state of Massachusetts pitch in $87 million to purchase a building for a private company, and then allow them to sell it for $252 million, and to give us back $98 million. This reminds me of when my mom sent me to the store with $20. I wasn't that great always at giving the change back with the candy, right? And so this is, again, the type of thing that we need to look at in terms of the deals that the state as well as municipalities cut with these large corporate entities.
I think it would be great one day to have a really detailed conversation as well about whether or not it's morally acceptable to keep trying to generate income by plopping casinos into depressed areas. Because I enjoy gambling recreationally. I love going to Las Vegas or, you know, to Foxwoods, but I think that's wrong.
Tom, hubbubs are supposed to be fun.
I know. I threw the dice on that one.
We're tight on time, but that's Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Tom, thanks.
Thank you.
And Tito Jackson, CEO of Verdant Medical and former Boston City Councilor. Thank you as well.
Shout out to Boston Answering, which is happening this weekend.
All right. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here, because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. This is music from White, a new work which will premiere at Boston Calling Music Festival this weekend. But of course, we have a bit of a twist here. There won't be a rock band on stage during the premiere, but four dancers from the Boston Ballet. And here to tell us more about that is Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell. Hi, Zoe.
Hello, Jamie.
So on Saturday, you walk into the music festival and you see ballet? That's kind of weird.
Yeah, so this is the 10th Boston Calling, and it's the first time they've had just dance on stage, but it actually makes sense. You know, Boston Calling, like all other music festivals, has become about more than just the music. Mm. There's comedy, which draws in some big names. Last year, they featured Pod Save America and a film festival by Natalie Portman, curated by her. So they've been experimenting with different things.
Sort of reaching out, touching new audiences. So this year, you know, as we mentioned, they're introducing Boston Ballet, and I should say that Boston Ballet is a financial supporter of WBUR, but the ballet will perform four times on two different stages. What are they performing?
Yeah, a variety of stuff, but I think the music will fit in nicely at Boston Calling. There's a piece set to R&B artist Khalid's hit song, Location, and two original works. And White I found particularly interesting because of the concept and the team behind it. It's by Sage Humphreys, a choreographer and an artist with the Boston Ballet. She's just 21 years old, wow. And she describes the piece as listening to rock music and, like, having it come to life.
Okay, but a rock and roll-inspired ballet piece, what does that even look like?
So it's a new spin on two classics. You got classical ballet set to original music that weaves together four iconic songs from the Beatles, hence the title, White, the White Album by the Beatles. All the music is by Sage's brother, Michael Humphreys, of the band Future Self. And here's a little bit of Michael singing some of the music.
Now somewhere in the Black Mountain hills of Dakota, there lived a young boy named Rocky Raccoon. And one day his woman ran off with another guy, hit young Rocky in the eye. Rocky pretty, didn't like that.
Pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
I kind of like it.
Bobbing
funky.
Your head there.
Yeah. And, you know, ballet, it's mixed with popular music before. Pop star Sia's collaborated with a ballet dancer. Past work from Kanye West has featured ballerinas. But in all those instances, ballet is kind of in the background or in addition to the music. And what Sage is really trying to do is make ballet the centerpiece. And I actually spoke with her at Boston Ballet's studio about what that really means for the art form.
This is an opening for ballet because ballet also needs to evolve with the times. It's such a classical art form that, you know, was created so many years ago, and the classics are always relevant. But if you can take those classical elements and modernize them, then you're able to have longevity with an art form. So I think that it's very important for this industry to modernize and move with the times. And it's also amazing that people going to listen to music are going to discover something that they weren't expecting to see either.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking of modernizing with the story, right, you're kind of trying to tell a pretty modern story with the movement and your dancers and their costumes. Can you tell me what that story is?
My inspiration for the piece was my brother and I just growing up listening to rock together, just in our living room jamming out, having jam sessions with my family. And that feeling of just kind of home base, that's what this type of music always brings me back to. So I wanted the feeling of even the choreography to be kind of chill, kind of homey, kind of reminiscent of a simpler time. But then you're listening to these songs and you're like, wait, I know this song, but I don't know this song at all. So I wanted the dance to also reflect, like, you know, this is ballet, but it's also something I've never seen before.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when I originally came here, like, hearing the music, it kind of wasn't what I expected. Like, when I heard Rock and Roll Tribute, I thought it was going to be a little bit more straight up rock and roll, I guess. And I actually appreciated the Rocky Road and the Obladi, how it kind of has this, like, ephemeral feel, and you can hear what's happening. And you recognize the you know, those iconic moments, but it's just reinterpreted for a new, you know, in a new way and for a new audience, like you're saying, right?
Wow, I'm so honored that you were able to pick that up, because that's exactly what I was going for. The music process was really all Michael's genius, you know, to take these iconic songs and then kind of rethink them. That's a huge task, because it's like taking a classic piece of art and saying, I'm going to go and redo it. So I think that he was able to recreate the songs in a way that does honor to the old music, but also completely reintroduces it to a new audience that maybe didn't grow up listening to the Beatles.
Yeah. So I was thinking earlier today about other times when dance has been kind of incorporated with rock and roll in different ways. And what came to my mind were things like the American Idiot musical by Green Day. And like, there's a High Fidelity musical, apparently, just like those kind of performances. And I feel like that idea of combining dance and rock isn't necessarily a new one, but ballet kind of feels new to me, but I guess I would just be interested, why set ballet to this type of music? You know, why did you want to take it in this new direction?
Because they contrast each other, because it's two extremes, because you have a bass drop in Oblah-Dee, and then you have choreography that you would see in like the Nutcracker at the same time. How completely contrasting are those things, but how beautifully they actually go together. That's not something that you would initially ever think of. It wouldn't be the first thing that comes to mind when you're thinking of like a hip-hop music video. You're thinking hip-hop, but ballet is such a stark contrast to that, that I think it has a shock factor to it. And that's just the way that I see the world.
Black birds singing in the dead of night.
That's Boston Ballet's Sage Humphrey speaking with Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell, and she's still here with me. Zoe, thank you for bringing us that delightful little report there.
Thanks so much, Jamie.
Stay with us. Coming up, former Vermont Governor Madeleine May Kunin on her life in politics. I'm Jamie Bologna, and this is Radio Boston.
All your life, you've been only waiting for this moment to arrive. Blackbird.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna.
By eroding or reversing Roe v. Wade, I think it'll create a kind of tension, a kind of anger, a kind of explosion that we don't fully appreciate.
This is former Governor of Vermont Madeleine May Kunin in 1991, testifying during the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
And to push the clock back, I think will create an eternal battlefield that will be very, very painful.
I think we are on a battlefield, and I think it's very detrimental, not only for women, but for society as a whole.
That last clip is Kunin today in 2019. As some states put restrictions on abortions, this week Vermont joined states going the other way, protecting the right to choose. Madeleine May Kunin has been on the front lines of important issues for decades. Kunin is now 85, and she's out with a memoir, Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. She fled Nazi Europe for America and has had an incredible career here. Governor of Vermont, ambassador to Switzerland, deputy secretary of education in Washington, author, feminist, mother, wife, immigrant. And she talked about how it feels to add former to some of those titles.
Well, the former is still present in my experience, you know, in creating the person I am today. It has shaped me. So I still consider myself to be a feminist, to be have the experience of having been a governor and ambassador. And now I have a new title, which I enjoy, and that is author and poet. And being a former whatever gives you a certain freedom. When you're in public life, you have to be more careful. So with my book, Coming of Age, I felt almost liberated at the age of 85. And I enjoy my new title just as much as I did the old ones.
Well, you mentioned your book. It's Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. And I'm struck by that subtitle, to the 80s. That journey isn't over. As you said, you're 85 now. You're well into your 80s.
Right. In the book, I tried to describe how it feels to be in the 80s, how as an old person, I'm tempted to say older, but I really should say old. We still shy away from that kind of language. I have some distance from my life's experience, and I feel I can be more forthright. I don't have to be so cautious.
It also seems like you're coming face to face with your reality. I mean, there's a picture of you right on the cover, and there you are in your full glory. And in the first sentences of your book, you say, "Death's black raven perches on my shoulder from time to time. Even when he flies away, I know he is in the neighborhood." That's not something you see in a book every day.
I guess not. I mean, you can't help but think about death. You can't let it dominate your thoughts, otherwise you don't have any fun anymore. But when you're 85, you don't think in 5-year terms or 10-year terms. What will you do then? You think in ones or twos or threes. And you know, my husband and I talked about carpe diem, live for the moment, live for the day. And that's what we have to do.
So, Governor, you mentioned your husband, John, and he died last year, and I'm sorry for your loss. He's a very integral part of this story. It's very much a love story in your book. And I guess I'm wondering, in the year since his death, how you've handled his loss.
Well, in a way, it seems more real now than it did a year ago. I think that's true for a lot of people who lose a loved one. You sort of think more about the things you did together and the things you can't do anymore. The thing I miss most, I guess, is showing him my writing. He always read everything, and he read most of this book. So it's still a loss, but you can cope with it. I don't want to sit in a rocking chair and just watch the world go by. I still want to be involved as much as I can.
I'm wondering how you think we've gotten it wrong in regards to how we think about and treat aging Americans, and maybe if you have a message to younger people.
Well, I think we see the aged as a problem that's going to break the bank financially to support the elderly. I mean, sometimes in articles when they talk about the aging American population, world population, I've seen the word tsunami, that we're going to be overrun. And sometimes the aging or the elderly are simply ignored. I think particularly as women, we're aware of that. People just don't see us. People just dismiss the aging as not being interesting. But advice is hard to give, though it is sometimes sought. I think just treat the elderly like people, like you would anybody else. And ask them questions and share your own thoughts, because we're very curious about young people. So just to keep connected with life, if possible, just lead as healthy and basic a life as you can and stay in touch.
That's beautiful. You make this very clear in your book that there's a double standard when it comes to men and women in terms of aging. How have you seen that in your career?
Oh, wow, that's a big question. I think as the first woman in any menu, you're watched. You know, can you do this? Can you do the job as it's been held by men forever? And so when I was elected governor, I think I was scrutinized in a way that another man would not have been. You have to be more conscious of things that are small, like how you dress. And, of course, we're seeing this in the candidates for the Democratic nomination for president. The whole question of likability has come out in the news. Women have to be both feminine and masculine. Masculine enough to hold the job like it's always been carried out, tough enough to be commander-in-chief, but then also warm and cuddly and likable. And, of course, Hillary was the key character of that dilemma. She was taken apart no matter what she did. It couldn't be quite right. But the exciting news is that there are 4 or 5 women running for presidents.
At least by my count, I have around 6 right now.
All right. I don't want to lose any of them. So the women are still saying, I'm going to get out there and do it. I'm not going to be scared off and pushed off the podium just because I'm female. So hopefully we get to a point where we say, I'm going to judge this candidate for what she stands for, not whether she wears a red jacket or a white jacket.
Well, I'm glad you brought up women in politics, because I was reminded so starkly by your positions during that Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on Clarence Thomas in 1991, because you sat there with a panel of other female activists, and you said this to the panel of male senators before you.
Once again, when it comes to our issues, we find ourselves repeating the ancient cycle of helplessness that women have experienced throughout history. The sense of powerlessness is painful. It is apparent right here in this room, where women are not equally represented in the decision-making process of this country. We are put in the position of pleaders, asking you to ask our questions for us, to be our stand-ins, to intercede on our behalf.
And now here we are in 2019, almost three decades after you said that. And the House is the most heavily female in history, and there are 25 female U.S. senators. Are you hopeful for the next election cycle?
I have to be hopeful, but, you know, when you play that clip, I really did feel anger. Anger that we were the pleaders, we were the outsiders, we had to ask them for the favor of listening to our cause. And yes, I am hopeful, but the question is, who is on the committees that make the decisions? We need more than just partial representation. We need to get to half and half, 50% women.
So I know it's the early days of the 2020 race, but at least as of now, former Vice President Joe Biden is leading in many of the polls, and I'm just wondering what you make of that.
Well, I'm glad he's changed. I'm glad that he sees the errors of his earlier days. The worst part of that hearing in that period was that they didn't believe the accusations.
And you mean, of course, Anita Hill and the hearing of Clarence Thomas.
Yes, and she was almost made fun of, and that was just outrageous.
And, of course, Biden has been reconciling with some of his past behavior and perhaps his inappropriate touching of women. And in your book, you write about your own experiences with comments and kissing and the way men treated you through the years. In a sort of post-Me Too era, are you encouraged by these societal changes on this front?
Yes. I mean, we're saying things out loud that we didn't say out loud before. If we did, we just confided to a friend. We would have sort of this secret life where we could confide in one another. It's now out there in the public arena. So some people say, well, maybe it's not fair to men. Maybe we're accusing them unfairly. But I think what we've really created is a forum for discussion about sexual harassment. And the consequences of that discussion are real. So it's a bright day.
And Governor Cunin, you also served in the Clinton administration, and I'm also just wondering if you think differently about his behavior with women through the years.
Well, it was a shock when everything came out, but I'm afraid I was a very strong Clinton supporter, so I probably didn't react with as much outrage as would have been appropriate. And yes, it was, as we like to say, complicated. You can't come up with a totally good answer. It was abhorrent what he did, but he seemed to reconcile some of us by the kind of president he was.
Another moment in your book that really struck me was when you write about the important role of the ladies' room in your political career as a place to cry.
Yes, in Vermont, it's a citizen legislature, so we don't have our own offices. There's no place to go and be private except maybe out the door. So the ladies' room becomes, when necessary, the crying room, where you can just say what you think and let go. You sort of have to keep your sanity because you don't want to cry in public. That's the long-standing taboo for women, and crying is a sign of weakness. Now, when men cry, it's almost a sign of strength But I did cry in the ladies' room, and I walked out feeling better.
I'm wondering if some of these qualities as a leader, as a mother, came from your own mother. And I'm wondering if you could tell me about what she was like.
Well, she was a strong woman, and I'm more aware of her strength now when I'm older. My father died when I was 2 and a half. So in today's vernacular, she was a single parent, and she was bringing up me and my brother. And we came to America not speaking much English, and she made her way. And she also instilled in us certain values. She was very patriotic. In America, anything is possible. That's what she taught the two of us, and that's what we believed in.
And then later, when you became ambassador to Switzerland, your native Switzerland, I'm curious if you could tell us about the importance of reconnecting to your Swiss roots.
Well, it was a wonderful round trip, leaving Switzerland in 1940 at the outbreak of World War II and coming to America. And my mother never dreamt, and I never dreamt, of course, that someday I'd come back as the American ambassador. It was a lovely homecoming. The only flaw in the story is that the big issue facing me in Switzerland as an ambassador was the role of Switzerland during World War II, and the Swiss banks had been a receptacle for money from Jews who wanted to deposit their funds in a safe place. And after the war, when either the heirs of those who were killed or survivors wanted to get their money back, the banks had a very hard time letting anybody in. So when I was ambassador, part of my job was to retrieve those funds to the rightful owners.
And you faced some anti-Semitism because of that, right?
I don't know if it was because of that. It was subtle anti-Semitism. I mean, nobody came up to me and said, you know, I don't like Jews. It was just that I was identified as a Jew, which in America I never was. You know, I wasn't the Jewish governor. It just wasn't an important question on my resume. But I also had a reunion with some of my Swiss cousins, and I felt I had a purpose as an ambassador. And to retrieve those funds was a wonderful cause. I didn't solve it completely, but we made an important first step in bringing back some of the funds. And then I had a moment of identification when the Swiss banks published the accounts that they couldn't identify, and my mother's name was on that. And all of a sudden, I became part of the story. But it turned out when everything was settled, the account turned out to be $150, which I shared with my brother.
Wow, that's an amazing story. Governor Cunin, I'm wondering about Vermont. Are there developments in Vermont today that both worry you and maybe ones that make you happy?
I think what worries me is that parts of the state are prospering and doing very well, like Chittenden County. And other parts of the state, the more rural parts and some cities, are having a hard time. And we'd like to be more attractive to young people, finding the delights of living in Vermont. And we still have to protect our gorgeous landscape and our farms. We're losing a lot of farms. People would like to live in Vermont, but they have to have a job. So we still have to do more to attract young people and keep them here so they want to raise a family.
Looking back on your amazing life, your career, is there anything that you would have done differently?
Oh, wow. When I graduated from Columbia School of Journalism, my dream job was to work for the Washington Post or the New York Times. So I never got to either one, except I did get to the New York Times when the editorial board wanted to interview me. And I went to the New York Times building, and I was with my state trooper who was in civilian clothes. And we knocked on the door, and their security person came up, looked at my trooper, shook his hand, and said, "Welcome to the Times, Governor." So I did make it to the New York Times after all.
Finally, Governor Kunin, how would you like to be remembered? Perhaps the Kunin legacy?
I don't think in terms of the Kunin legacy, because life changes so much. I think you have to live for the present. I guess I'd just like to be known as a good human being, somebody who cared about the state, loved the state, and tried to improve the lives of the people who live in it. And whatever small or big steps that happened in my administration had a part in that. But we don't know for how long or how much, and just feel happy that I had the chance to be governor of the state. I mean, I wasn't a likely candidate. I was a woman. I was Jewish. I didn't have a business background. But somehow the people of Vermont trusted me.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good legacy to me.
Thank you so much.
Madeline May Kunin is a professor at large at the University of Vermont. She's founder of the group Emerge Vermont, a former U.S. ambassador to Switzerland and former governor of Vermont. Her memoir is Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. Governor Kunin, it's been a true honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to me. Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today and this week. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Jamie Bologna, and I hope you all have a lovely Memorial Day weekend, and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.